This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After Tina Cassidy had a baby in 2004, she says the women of her family gave her three things: newborn outfits, advice, and accounts of their own birth experiences. Those accounts inspired her to write a book about the medical and cultural practices surrounding childbirth. Her book is called Birth: The Surprising History of How We Are Born. Before she became a mother, Cassidy was a reporter and editor at the Boston Globe. By the way, parents, there are parts of this interview you would probably not find appropriate for young children. We're going to be talking about childbirth and some of the things that can go wrong. When Tina Cassidy was pregnant, she drew up a birth plan that included getting an epidural for the pain only if absolutely necessary. But reality didn't conform to the plan. Things were going fine until she got to the hospital.
When I got there, they said, okay, it's time to get hooked up to your IV now, just so that you'll be ready for your epidural. And that's sort of when a lot of the tension started. I said, you know, I don't think I want an epidural, and I definitely don't need an IV. I'm not dehydrated, and I'm sure I can have a sip of water as things progress if I get really thirsty, but is this really necessary? And, you know, so they kept sort of pushing this system. And as I was probably moving close to transition, which was this, you know, the most intensive part of active labor, I was in excruciating back labor. And I think it's because my baby was posterior. He was facing sunny side up, if you will. And the normal position for a baby to come out is facing down. So the back of his head was pressing on my spine. And, you know, there are lots of things that can be done to alleviate that sort of back pain. But it was one of the busiest nights on the labor floor that they had had in quite some time. So they just kept coming in and saying, are you ready for your epidural now? Are you ready? Are you ready? And I kept saying, no, no, no. And I tried all these other things. And my husband, I could see, he was starting to come apart. And finally, I consented to it, and the epidural certainly worked in terms of pain relief, but of course it confined me to my hospital bed because I was numb from the waist down. And I think that that sort of set in stone the way my labor was going to be as I continued to dilate and the baby tried to move down. He sort of got stuck in that position and was not able to fully rotate.
And then you ended up having a C-section.
I ended up having a C-section, yes, after 4 hours of pushing. You know, I don't think any amount of pushing was going to get him down, and he was stuck in this wrong position. It was like fitting a square peg through a round hole, and it just wasn't happening. So I asked them to shut the epidural off so that I could try to get up and walk around, and maybe that would move the baby around a little bit more and help him to descend, but it didn't. And the pain intensity of going from no pain with the epidural to 100 times the pain that I thought I could ever endure as a woman, you know. So at that point when they said, you need a C-section, I said, fine, just hurry up and get it over with. It was really bad. Now, the baby, of course, was fine through all of this. If anything had, you know, if there was any indication at all that my son was at risk, I would have consented much sooner, but everything was fine with him. It was me having the trouble.
Tina, why did you want to examine the history of childbirth after you gave birth yourself?
Well, the day after I had my son, I was still groggy and in bed, and my obstetrician came in to check on me, and my husband was sitting there, and he said, he was still sort of distraught and trying to make sense of what had happened the night before. And he's a journalist as well, and so he started firing off questions at her. And he said one of the questions was, what would have happened 500 years ago if you couldn't have just wheeled her down the hall so easily for the C-section? And her answer was really what brought me down this road of wanting to look at what women did do 500 years ago and what did they do 1,000 years ago. And why is it that after having babies for so long, we still haven't figured out the best way to do it? And why is it that every generation has its own way of giving birth? It seems like such a natural physiological process, and yet it's different from mother to daughter and so on. And I just really needed to make sense of that. And once I started doing research, I realized how little I knew. After all the reading I had done for my own pregnancy and birth, I felt like I had no context for how we got to where we are today.
So when your husband said what would have happened if it was 500 years ago and you couldn't have a cesarean section, mm-hmm. what did the nurse say?
Well, it's pretty awful procedure. If you want me to go into the details of it here, I will, but I'll just give you a little forewarning that it's pretty gruesome. The procedure that she talked about was called a craniotomy, and this was almost always done when the baby was already dead because the labor had stopped because the baby was stuck and couldn't come out, and that would have involved collapsing the fetal skull and then pulling the baby out bit by bit. So this was done in an effort to save the life of a mother, because if the baby had been left inside, the body would begin to disintegrate and poison the mother, and then she would die too. Now, the truth is that craniotomy didn't save as many women as you might think, for a couple of reasons, and one was this happened quite often before there were antiseptic techniques and long before antibiotics were available. So many women died of infection from use of dirty tools or dirty hands, and sometimes her birth canal would get punctured by these horrific tools, so she could bleed to death, or infection could be introduced that way as well. So it was such a horrible image when she said this. I sort of didn't want to believe that it was true. And that was really what launched me on this journey to see if it was true.
Now, you were born in 1969, and when your mother gave birth to your brother in 1976, she took Lamaze childbirth classes with your father attending. What are some of the ways that natural childbirth has changed since your brother was born?
Well, I will add that my brother was born by cesarean section, even though she took those Lamaze classes, so I just wanted to add that note. But natural birth has really come full circle. It grew out of this movement to anesthetize women while they were in labor. If you ask your grandmother, what her births were like, more than likely she will not remember. She would have been knocked out. And so the next generation, this was the generation of my mother, they wanted to be a part of their birth experiences. They wanted to remember what that was like. And I think that birth is always a reflection of the culture in which it happens. And if you think about the culture of these generations, my grandmother's generation, she had babies in the 40s for the most part. And these were women who were didn't have very many options. And childbirth was just something that they, for the most part, succumbed to. And then when my mother's generation came around, it was all about liberation and being in control and being strong women. And so I think that's why being a part of birth became so important to them. And I think today, women are struggling to find balance in their lives. And that's why we want to be part of birth, so we don't want to be completely anesthetized. But we also don't want to feel the pain, which is why epidurals, I think, are so popular. And so natural birth was a very important part of a cultural movement in the 60s and 70s. And there are still some women today who I think feel very strongly about natural birth, but culturally it's not where the majority of women in this country are at. And I think that's why you don't hear so many people talk about their natural birth experiences. It's all about the epidural or getting a cesarean section or just going to the hospital when labor starts, as opposed to giving birth at home, which was something that was much more common just 20 years ago.
Why is childbirth so much more difficult for human beings than for other animals?
Well, humans are the only mammal species that needs help to give birth. And the reason for that is because we walk upright, and our bipedal structure means that we have a more narrow pelvis to support the weight of our body. And we're reasonably intelligent, so our babies tend to be born with larger crania. And so to fit that crania through the pelvis, the baby actually starts out descending head down in a normal scenario, ear to ear, lined up with the widest part of the pelvis, which is hip to hip. But the widest outlet of the pelvis is front to back. So the baby actually has to rotate as it descends in order to fit through this newly structured pelvis, if you will, to support us upright. And that makes birth very complicated for humans, which is not to say that it's not easy for some women, and it's not to say that, you know, by and large, babies fit through just fine. But that's why it is more complicated. Monkeys, for example, can give birth in a couple of minutes, and the baby just shoots straight down the birth canal. It doesn't have to rotate. So you can see why we would need help to help facilitate either the baby turning or to provide support for the mother over a day or more of labor. And a lot of people think that midwives were sort of an evolutionary adaptation to help the mother. There have been some studies that have shown that if a mother labors totally alone or if she's fearful, that the labor stalls or drags out, and she's actually at greater risk. And so if you think about the midwife as an adaptation to this problem, you know, you think, okay, you've got sort of the perfect solution.
You know, in talking about the difficulty that human women have giving birth, it's fascinating to see some of the different positions for childbirth that have been recommended over the years.
Right.
You want to just run through some of those for us? I mean, obviously in a lot of the 20th century, like women were on their back with their legs in stirrups, kind of like for a gynecological exam.
Right.
Is that considered a bad position now?
That is considered the worst possible position because it puts the pelvis in a position where the baby almost has to fight gravity to get up out of the birth canal. The best position, and cultures around the world have always squatted, and so we know that, you know, this is a very comfortable position for labor, and it's actually a position that helps aid labor, and you're working with gravity to help get the baby out. There were other positions, too, that were sort of interesting. When doctors first took over from midwives, there was a lot of shyness on the mother's part because they still felt very modest about having a man look at them. And by the same token, these male physicians didn't want to be looking at the woman either. So a lot of this was done blind. The mother would be told to be on her side and she would be covered with sheets. And then this would allow the physician to help get the baby out. But this was done for the doctor's convenience, not necessarily for the mother's. And then today, of course, we're mostly on our backs in the hospital because we're hooked up to epidurals.
But if that's a bad position, why are we doing it that way?
Because we don't want to feel the pain. If you have an epidural, you can't stand up for the most part. There are some walking epidurals, but and it's very difficult to squat. You can't support yourself on numb legs. It's, you know, if you think about how difficult it is to talk after having your jaw numbed during a dental exam, think about what it's like to have the whole weight of your body plus the baby pushing down on your numb legs.
You know, one of the questions you ask in your book is when did men get admitted to the delivery room and who's behind that decision?
Mm-hmm.
So what's the answer to the question?
Well, there are a couple of factors that happened, and they all built on each other. One famous obstetrician who is believed to be the father of natural childbirth, Grantley Dick Reed, he was an Englishman, and he thought that it was okay for fathers to be there for the birth as long as they didn't get overexcited. Then came Fernand Lamaze, the French obstetrician whom we all know, and he also said it was okay for fathers to be there. His method didn't really take off in the U.S. until the 60s and for the most part in the 70s. But then along came another American doctor called Dr. Bradley, and he believed that the man was actually the best labor and birth coach. So he was the first one to be far more proactive and made the man part of the whole program. So the father would be the one at the end of the bed coaching, saying, you know, come on, you can push, and then sometimes even caught the baby and cut the umbilical cord.
Let me ask you about like a current trend in childbirth, mm-hmm. and that is that about 50% of laborers in America now are induced. You wrote an article for the New York Times magazine not long ago about induced labors, and as you wrote, a lot of women are inducing labor for scheduling reasons. Either they're afraid their doctor's going to be gone, or their husband will be away, or they have something they have to take care of. Is that considered controversial?
I think obstetricians are somewhat immune to this idea by now because it's been going on for a while. But I think To ask to be induced because you want to watch the Super Bowl is outrageous. I mean, interfering with your labor and birth to that degree for no medical indication can have serious outcomes for mother and baby. And I think we need to be a little bit more careful and more respectful of the natural process than we have been.
Let's talk about painkillers a little bit. Would you say that the women you know of your age want to avoid painkillers if possible during delivery and want to just kind of like, you know, go it alone without that?
I would say probably half of the women I know want to avoid an epidural. This is what they say before they've gone into labor anyway. But then when they get into labor and they feel the pain, they either say, get me an epidural now, or they try to hold off and they have a situation like I did where the hospital staff says, do you want your epidural now? Do you want your epidural now? So they feel pressured to have it. And I'm not saying that women don't deserve the responsibility for accepting that epidural, but, you know, the hospital system is definitely set up so that women get it.
Have epidurals been improved over the decades?
Oh, absolutely. They used to be quite bad. Even 30 years ago, you know, women would be numb up to their necks and it could cause cardiac problems and, you know, they would have serious headaches because the needles were a little bit too big. It could cause some dura to seep from the spinal column, and then that would make the brain actually sag, so it would pull on connective tissue. But since then, epidurals have improved quite a bit, which is not to say that there aren't drawbacks to using the epidural today. It makes pushing much more difficult, and the pushing phase is often extended for women who have epidurals. And it can causes fevers in mothers and babies. There's a big study being done on that right now, but I think most people would agree that the epidurals are probably the culprit for fevers.
You mentioned that earlier in the history of painkillers in childbirth, that there were religious and moral debates about whether women should be taking painkillers. What were those debates like?
Well, they were quite passionate and fiery debates. In the Bible, it says, in sorrow thou shalt bring forth children, and that's in Genesis. And it was because of that biblical passage that the church for a long time tried to say that it was a sin to attempt to alleviate pain during childbirth. This was Eve's curse. This was a woman's station in life. She had to bear it. And so when people came along and said, we have ways of eliminating pain, they were ridiculed and the church came out and attacked them. And it just so happens that the father of obstetrical anesthesia, James Young Simpson, was a Scotsman, and he was very good about finding his own biblical passages to fight back with. And he said, you know, it also says in the Bible that when God took the rib from Adam to give to Eve, that Adam fell into a deep sleep. So he said, well, isn't that the same thing as anesthesia? And what's good for Adam, shouldn't that be as good for Eve? So that was the argument that went around and around.
If you were pregnant again, what would you do to prepare, and what do you think you would insist on?
Well, because I've had one C-section already, I'm automatically labeled high risk. So my options are limited. I would not be allowed to go to a birth center. There are a lot of people who would not help me through labor at home. And so by going to the hospital, I think I'd be in a lot of the same situations as before. I would definitely have a midwife this time. And I would be much firmer in my request to not have as much intervention as I had the last time.
Why would you want to use a midwife this time around, considering how difficult your first labor was?
Right. Well, I think a midwife tends to err on the side of patience and watching and waiting and also coming up with more positive ways to try to get labor and birth going, where a doctor might say, well, you've been pushing for 3 hours. It's about the length of time that we're comfortable with. Maybe it's time to have a C-section. A midwife would probably say, you need to get up and walk around. You need to bounce on a ball. You need to, you know, really focus on your pushing a little bit more. So that it's really just a completely different approach to guiding a woman through labor.
Well, Tina Cassidy, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Terry. It's my pleasure.
Tina Cassidy is the author of the new book, Birth, A History of How We Are Born.